Karma Yoga is so called because yoga has always three aspects. There is an object of yoga, there is an instrument of yoga, and there is the method of yoga. When these three are combined together, it is the complete system of yoga. The object of yoga, the instrument of the yoga, and the method of yoga. Now, what is the object of yoga? The object is, even while doing actions, you become free. That is the object. What is the instrument? There can be three instruments. The instrument may be intellect. The instrument can be knowledge. That is one. Instrument can be will. Or the instrument can be emotion. There are three instruments. If you analyze the whole psychology of human being, you find there are three instruments. There is knowledge, there is will, and there is emotion. Either of these three can be your instrument. Karma Yoga is called Karma Yoga because will is taken as instrument. Will is active power in us. Therefore, it is a Karma Yoga. If you take intellect and knowledge as the means, it is called Jnana Yoga. If you take emotion as the means, it is called Bhakti Yoga. So the distinction between one yoga or the other depends upon the instrument that we are using. The object is, while doing works you want to be free. That is the object. The instrument is will. And what is the method? This is the method. We have just started describing the method, but let us repeat now. The method is that in us, the active energy at present is impulse and desire. All that is active within us at a given stage in our consciousness, when we start, we find that that which is very active in us, that which is pressing upon us very much, is desire. Therefore, Sri Krishna says that you take desire in your hands and do something about it. That is the method. Apply method on desire. Like a scientist, you look into your consciousness and see where exactly the desire rests. What is it impelling you to do? What is it counseling you to do? You will find, for example, if you take the drama of Macbeth, Macbeth was a faithful general of the army of Duncan. He was a king. He was very faithful. After a victory somewhere, when he was returning with his friends, three witches meet him on the way. And they receive him by saying, "Hail the king." That is to say, they address him as the king. Now, as soon as this happens, in him a desire is ignited. He is now a different man. Something is injected into him, and desire is injected into his consciousness. And the entire drama is nothing but the action of this desire. He even goes again to the ghost, to these witches, to be sure whether what they had said was an accident or whether it was really something intended. And they assure him that he is destined to be the king. To know that he is destined to be the king is not enough. The desire is such a powerful instrument that even when you say this has happened, going to happen, the intent, the desire impels you to do something about it. Lady Macbeth, for example, when she hears this, then she impels him to arrange something by which this can be realized, this dream, this prediction can be fulfilled. And they come to decide to even plotting of the killing of the king, so that after that king's murder, Macbeth can become the king. The plot was to invite the king to, for dinner, for banquet at home. And then, at home, when he's sleeping after the banquet, there's a terrible scene of Lady Macbeth and Macbeth, and how Lady Macbeth impels Macbeth to murder, and what hesitations take place. But all this is a play of desire. I give this example because this is one of the very clear analyses of desire given by Shakespeare in this drama. How the desire really plays. What restlessness. How the will is turned downward for satisfaction of desire. And how various kinds of images bewilder the mind, and how ultimately the act is performed, and which is not the end. No action has the end. It goes on, and there are consequences. And the whole tragedy of Macbeth is this desire, action, and its consequences.